which will be coming up, which I promised that we would be playing a couple of weeks ago. We were doing some interviews since then, but we're going to be now playing the first episode of the Witch Hunter Chronicles, and then we're going to be playing episode 2 of the Leviathan Chronicles. So that's going to be coming up momentarily here on CITR 101.9 FM. So stay tuned, relax, and don't go away.
On May 30th, Bestie celebrates the release of their new album, No Bad Days, at Fortune Sound Club. Plus, special guests Sunshine, Needs, Derival, and the Can I Live DJs. Advanced tickets are available at High Life, Zulu, Red Cat, and Beat Street Records, or online at TicketZone.com. For more information, go to FortuneSoundClub.com.
So now the darkness is complete.
You know who I am, don't you?
Yes, I know. You are Death.
And you are aware of your position?
It's all over. Yes, I'm aware of that.
Oh, don't be so gloomy, good man. Do you find this darkness disturbing?
No. No, I find it strangely comforting.
You're in the womb of the afterlife now. The time has come to answer to me for all you have done and all you have forsaken to do. Now the measure of your life must be taken, and then, only if you are found worthy, may you look upon the countenance of our sweet goddess.
I do not believe my heart is pure enough to merit that. But before you judge me, let me tell you that I have seen the face of suffering and braved the sight of despair. I know what it means to hate, yes, but also what it is to love. I have a name, and I have a story.
Death is not so quick to judge, my friend. All those who have come here to my abode are given the chance to sit down and tell their tales. As you bring to me the story of your life, I will complete it for you by showing you the other side of it. Tell me your name, and tell me who you were in your life.
My name was Ludlov, and I was a witch hunter.
Ludlov, my friend. Begin.
I will not tell you of my youth and my first love, for it will have little bearing on my presence here. No, I will commence with a part where the story truly begins. A tale like none even you have ever heard.
Ah, thank you. That is most appreciated. Not all new ones are as considerate for weary old death as you in that respect. Begin where you will, but let your tale be one that speaks of who you are.
Very well, old man. I have lived my whole life in the great city of Seven Peaks. Round and tall it was, and in its center stood the cathedral, a building both proud and dark. Surrounding this great feat of architecture and the grand marketplace before it, there were seven spires that gave the city its name. I cannot say it was a safe haven, for Seven Peaks was full of evil. Corruption, crime, decay. a society torn between a lifeless, blasé aristocracy and the mass of oppressed commoners so far removed from the notions of hope and improvement that they simply accepted the unpleasantness of their brief lives. But despite all of this, the city was home. I had tasted happiness, experienced what it meant to love and be loved. And then I had lost it. And ever since that day, nothing seemed daunting anymore. Nothing seemed joyous anymore. I did not flee anymore from suffering, and I did not seek anymore for pleasure. I was the perfect recipe for a witch hunter. I shall begin my tale now, on one dreadful night in the city. The year was 1477, 7 years after I had lost my wife and with her all that I used to be, at the hands of a cult of dark magicians, 7 years after I had become a member of the Witch Hunter Order, 7 years since my quest had begun to find and destroy the Black Sickle. It was autumn. I had just returned from a small quest in the wild outside the city, where very few others ever went. I had succeeded in finding and destroying a renegade necromancer, who proved to be only a minor trespasser in the end. I returned to the last inn outside of the city and considered exploring more of the forests now that I had the chance. But then I received a message, bearing a terrible warning, and so I returned and found the city to be in flames. It had all started when a bakery had caught on fire, or at least, that was the official story. Now the whole city was ablaze, with people fleeing through the gates with what little they had. Against the massive clouds above Seven Peaks, the reddish light of the inferno flickered demonically. The seven towers built around the cathedral were blackened with smoke.
I was there that night. Believe me, I had a lot of work in your city then. Let me recall. Yes, I remember seeing you. A mysterious man in a tall, broad-rimmed hat and a long, dark cloak. Hunched like an animal on the church balcony in the city, observing the scene with those piercing eyes, the rest of your face hidden behind your high collar. What were you thinking at that moment?
That there is no more deplorable sight than that of grandeur falling, and that this fire had been a willful act of destruction. My very instinct told me who the arsonists were, and that I had to act quickly. So then, without hesitation, I leapt from the balcony and landed in the city street. In front of me, there was a mass of panicked civilians running straight towards me, but I ignored the rabble and hastened forward, ever deeper into the city.
What were you looking for there, Ludlov?
My friend.
Curse it! Edomir's house is burning already. I must venture inside swiftly. Edomir! Edomir!
Ludlov. Yes, I recognize you. That's the price you pay for being famous, I gather. Your reputation precedes you, even when you don't want it to.
You are from the cult.
Well spotted. However, I had expected more from a witch hunter of your stature.
I am not here to exchange banter. I am here to find my friend. Now move aside or die.
Good friend, fear not. We of the Black Sickle have subtler methods to gain what we want than mere brute violence. The Black Sickle is always a few steps ahead, Ludlov. Let go of your hatred of us. We can use a man like you.
You could be our ally, Nerdlove. The greatest witch hunter of our time. On our side. And all the pain that haunts you. And all the madness that drives you could be taken away.
You forget why I am a successful witch hunter.
Cultist!
It's because I am immune to your seductive magics. And now for Edomir. Edomir! What the... Edomir! Let me take off that gag.
Nerdlove, you're too late.
Fear not. I will get us both out of this. Come on, I'll carry you.
No, Luke. No, Nerdlove. That log, it's falling! Edomir!
I'm too late. I must get out of this house. Mentor. Dead.
Curse you! Curse you to eternal death! Enemy of all!
No. No, I cannot allow my feelings to govern me now. There will be another time to find this enemy. I had better leave the city, or it will be left of it on the morrow. Quickly! Away!
Is that a young girl? She seems to be bending over the body of an old woman. Let me observe this from a bit closer.
Mother, mother, fight back. You still have a chance to live. Hold on for a little longer. This spell will clear your lungs of smoke and reduce the hurt of the burns. Just a few moments longer, mother. And I will heal you.
Oh no. Vathek. The worst bigot of all witch hunters.
Damn smoke! You there! Girl! What are you doing?
Please, sir. Just a moment. She's my mother. She's dying.
And what are you doing with her?
Healing?
Using magic?
Please, sir. Please, I...
Witch!
Sir, the fire!
Do you think the fire warrants the use of magic? All it does is bring out the true face of you demons. You know the laws, girl. And as there's no time to arrest you, I shall have to resort to the alternative.
What is...
All right, Vathek. That's enough. I hate to do this, but...
Sir, what are you going to do?
I'm going to clear the world of another stain upon its face.
It looks like I beat you to it, Vathek.
Who are you? I can't see you through the smoke.
Can you still save your mother?
I hope so. I have to be quick.
Then don't waste your time with me. It proved that I did not need to leave the city, for the fire stayed clear from the historical center, and there I had a room arranged in one of the better inns. I waited for a few days, and found that remarkably, the fire that had seemed so cataclysmic before could be vanquished in 2 days. The inns by this time had flooded with refugees and their stories. The devastation seemed horrifying. I realized it was time to report to the mayor, and so I prepared myself and made for his mansion. A tastelessly over-luxurious resort of enormous size, quite near the cathedral. I had always felt that this kind of secular display of glory in the face of our beloved spire was quite simply insulting to the goddess. But as a good witch hunter, I also knew that any argument with its occupant would be greatly undesired.
Yes?
Forgive me for my impertinence, good man, but I must speak to your master.
Ah, good love. The mayor is in his office. I shall take you to him at once. Master Grundheim, Your Excellency, may I present Master Ludlow?
Of course. Leave us.
Certainly.
Have a seat. What do you wish to discuss?
The enemy has struck.
I knew you witch hunters would find a scapegoat for the fire.
I'm not interested in scapegoats, sir. Only the truth.
Then who was this enemy whose existence is so obvious to you?
A dark cult by the name of the Black Sickle.
Why am I not surprised, Ludlow? I know what this is about.
Justice. It is about justice, sir.
No, Ludlow, it's not. It's about your personal need for satisfaction.
Sir, I have some tragic news.
Don't change the subject, Ludlow. You know I'm right.
On the eve of the fire, I received an anonymous letter saying tomorrow night, Adomir the Witch Hunter shall perish in his own flames. I was abroad at the time, but as soon as I received the letter, I hastened back to Seven Peaks. Upon my arrival, the city was already burning. I made my way to Adomir's house, where I encountered a cultist. He had locked my friend and mentor up in his room while the house was burning. I was unable to save him.
That is very grim news, Ludlow. I know the witch hunters have many enemies in magic societies.
The letter was signed thus.
The sign of...
And did I mention that the cultist's exact words were, "The Black Sickle is always a few steps ahead"?
Well, I...
It doesn't get much clearer, does it, sir? Oh yes, this is about personal satisfaction. But it is also the truth. Don't tell me the fire was an entirely unrelated accident. These are the perpetrators.
All right, Ludlow. What do you want?
The Black Sickle is gracious about giving away its actions because all the words Black Sickle represented this time is a faceless threat. But there is some greater design and definitely an evil mind behind all this, and I want to root it out. I want to crawl inside of them, unseen, unknown. Like a parasite slowly weakening its host, and thus I want to expose them and destroy them.
Inside?
Yes. Yes, it is the only way to bring them down. And maybe, just maybe, you could help me.
Oh?
Yes. Do you have any magical trespassers in your custody?
The jails are crowded with bandits and murderers, Ludlow. Not wizards, but... We do have one.
Interesting. Tell me about the spellcaster.
She's only a young girl, but surprisingly gifted. Her name is Samina. We arrested her on the basis of Rule 35.
Unauthorized magical healing?
Yes. Apparently her mother was severely wounded in the fire. She tried to save her, but then the city guards showed up and she had to break the spell.
She doesn't exactly sound like a troublemaker, but all right. If it's all we have to go with, I shall go speak with her.
Ludlow?
Yes?
Try to be a gentleman. She's been through a lot of pain already.
I am a witch hunter, sir. Not a gentleman. Samina? Samina. I am not an enemy. I would just like to have some words with you.
Not an enemy. Strange to hear that from someone dressed like a witch hunter.
I am a witch hunter.
And I am a witch, so don't tell me you are not my enemy.
But I speak the truth. Even if you don't believe me, the two of us have something in common, Samina. We are both misunderstood human beings.
It's hard to misunderstand people who burn others for trying to save lives.
First of all, I'm not going to burn you, and I will do all that there is in my power to keep you from such a fate. And secondly, if I had been there, Samina, I would not have let your mother die.
What is this? Some kind of trick to gain my confidence so that I tell you what I know? Don't count on it, Witch Hunter. I would rather die than give away anything to the likes of you.
My name is Ludlov.
How good for you, Ludlov.
You don't know why I am a witch hunter, do you, Samina?
I don't care. You don't know why I am a witch.
I think I do. You are a witch merely because your mother was a witch, and she taught you in the ways of magic, being one with the powers of the earth, healing, and taking care of those you love, yes. I've known witches like you before. In my book, you are hardly even witches at all. You are the children of nature.
And what are you, then?
I am a man. Just a man, in essence. But to the world, I am also a symbol of the complete eradication of magic. But what is a symbol? It's not who I am.
You chose to be that symbol, and so it is who you are.
I chose for it, that's true. But why? Because we, the Witch Hunter Order, with our swift and uncompromising methods, are the only things that the spellcasters fear.
But what?
I will confide in you, Samina, and I will tell you a secret. I am not a pleasant man by far. I have persecuted, killed, even, much as it grieves me, tortured. But never, ever, did I do any such thing to a truly innocent person. Do not mistake me for some of my colleagues. I am not a man who will hurt people for being something that I am not, or believing something that I do not, even if my order is one that does follow that creed. I, personally, am only after the true evils of this world. Those that snatch infants from their cradles, that drink blood and destroy lives. They are the ones who should fear me. It is only dark magic and its users that I wish to destroy.
If that is true, then why did you join Hoskiv's witch hunter bigots who make no such distinction?
Because we are all there is that can destroy the truly dark ones. And if I am indeed truthful and respect the children of nature such as yourself, is it then not best to have people like myself among the ranks of the Godmother's men?
Granted. But you stand for an ideal that is evil, Ludlov. You wear its uniform.
Those are my ways, Samina. I get inside, like a worm inside an apple. I did this with the Witch Hunter Order, and I intend to do it with the Black Sickle.
And what do you need me for?
You are the only magic user I can talk to at the time, and I want to know whether you know anything about the Black Sickle.
Are you making some cruel joke?
Why would I be?
I won't tell you anything.
Very well. Very well. If indeed you do know something about the Black Sickle that you refuse to tell me, then I can draw only one conclusion from that, Samina. You don't want to betray them.
I know nothing.
You do. I know you do, and I have patience. But my time is limited, and so is my trust in you. Await my return.
Thank you.
UBC faculty, staff, and alumni are invited to be part of the movement to help make UBC healthier. UBC Moving Minds is an annual free event promoting the use of breaks from work to support your health and well-being. Come anytime between 12 and 2 p.m. on Thursday, May 15th to Martha Piper Plaza for a short walk and receive a free stainless steel water bottle. For more information, contact kin.outreach@ubc.ca. That's kin.outreach@ubc.ca.
We be
A Jihad for Love, White Water Black Gold, A Red Girl's Guide to Reasoning, East Hastings Pharmacy, Ai Weiwei Never Sorry, Misrepresentation.
Cinema Politica UBC screens politically charged films with speakers and discussions every month. Screenings take place at the Norm Theater in the Sub and are by donation. To learn more, visit cinemapolitica.org/UBC.
The Leviathan Chronicles, an audio adventure. Chapter 2, A Secret Unfolds. New York City, today. A slender young woman with auburn hair sprinted up a small campus hill towards Founders Hall at Rockefeller University on York Avenue. The M15 bus that McAllen Orsell typically took from her East Village apartment was delayed by construction around Bellevue Hospital and left her stressed, frazzled, and late. McAllen had a great affection for the unique institution of Rockefeller University. It was a bucolic oasis in the middle of midtown Manhattan. It had its own gardens, tennis court, and overlooked the East River. But more importantly, it was one of the most advanced medical and scientific research institutions in the world. Founded by John D. Rockefeller in 1901, its mission has always been the advancement of theoretical and advanced research and experimentation. Rather than being a factory for producing orthopedic doctors and plastic surgeons, Rockefeller University functioned as a premier think tank for the best and brightest medical students in the country. It had also been the center of McAllen Orsell's life for the past 6 years. She gave a hurried wave to the security guard that stood post at the gated entrance on York and 64th Street. Once inside Founders Hall, she frantically pushed the elevator button to take her to the fifth floor, where the genetic research department was housed.
I know, don't say it.
Don't need to. Medical Provost Reiner wanted to see you in his office as soon as you get in. He's gonna bitch you out for being late a lot better than me teasing you.
Shit, seriously? He noticed I wasn't here?
No, I think he noticed your speech on primordial genetic mutation for his second years wasn't on his desk by the end of the day yesterday, like you promised. I think that's what's got him looking for you.
Are you on his side or mine?
I'm on the side that keeps me employed and enjoying benefits of research grants. Lest you forget, we're not all independently wealthy like you.
I'm not wealthy. I'm quite broke, actually.
I'm sorry. Then we don't all come from rich families that don't share with us because we're bad daughters.
I'm a great daughter. I just come from a strong lineage of outcasts from the family fortune. Trust me, Jimmy. We're on the right path. We're going to make an evolutionary breakthrough in genetics, and we'll have every foundation in the world breaking down our doors, trying to offer us research laboratories and crazy supercomputers.
Dude, I'd settle for a place where we don't have to pay a vending machine for rat-gut coffee every morning.
Stick with me, and I'll get you one of those fancy coffee makers with the pod cartridges.
And I'll be your sexy little caffeine whore.
I know you will. We'll put your coffee maker next to the waffle maker that you'll use every morning for me.
Oh, really?
Yes. Really? Oh, God, Jesus, I don't want to go into Reiner's office. I could easily... Oh, my God, wait, I forgot the sequencing modeling. Did you check it this morning?
I thought you'd never ask.
Don't gloat, just tell me, were we right?
Yes. Look here, the telomeres were lengthened in the flatworms by 600%. That would extend their lifetimes by at least 3.5 times. But McAllen, it wasn't a clean run. Cancerous cell activity also increased by over 300%, as well as other genetic mutations. In the simulation, we got our worms to live longer, but the extra time they got was riddled with sickness and complications. I wouldn't call it a success, but I think we have made some important steps.
Damn right we did. 600% increase in telomere regeneration activity? You have to rerun the simulation again, but this time input an iodine compound to track the free radical migration and isolate the decrepitude.
We can't do it, McAllen. The simulation you're talking about will take over 18 hours. If Reiner finds out, he'll napalm your grant, demote me, and probably sell our research to a Korean think tank to pay for his new Jaguar.
Come on, Jimmy. You know I'll make it worth your while.
Right. How late did you stay here last night working on the simulation?
Until about 3 hours ago.
No wonder you're late. Hello? She'll be right in. That was your other boyfriend. He'd like to see you in his office right away.
Great. That's all I need in my life, another cranky boyfriend.
Good morning, McAllen. Sit down.
Thank you, Dr. Reiner.
McAllen, please tell me what in the holy Lord's name is wrong with you.
I'm sorry? What do you mean?
You know exactly what I mean. You look exhausted. You've been neglecting your duties as a teaching assistant. I heard 2 weeks ago you didn't even show up to your Thursday morning class. The damn graduate students were playing broomball in the hallway waiting for you to show up.
Those students are so stupid.
No! You are so stupid for pissing away a prestigious grant on a pipe dream of science fiction instead of focusing on concrete research.
Sir, the Letterfield grant allows for funding in the field of the recipient's choosing as long as it furthers the advancement of cellular biology.
And using it for a genetic code-breaking exercise that's spitting out a bunch of gibberish that nobody
I understand it. We've made progress. And cellular biology is directly correlated to the human genetic code.
Oh, please, don't give me this thigh bone is connected to knee bone horse shit. I could call in the grant, McAllen. I could do it. I've got a report on my desk that shows you've been logging in for unauthorized use on the mainframe, running huge simulations and draining resources from the other department.
I did have authorization.
For 3 hours? You took 9. You're acting like you work at this university alone. Using any resources you see fit, neglecting your duties, siphoning off distinguished research grants to serve your own purposes. It's pretty sad, McAllen. It's sad for 2 reasons. One, you seem to have forgotten that the primary mission of this institution is to give back and return the scientific knowledge that we've been privileged to learn for the benefit of society. And second, you're throwing away a lot of promise and a career that I had previously taken an interest in nurturing.
What greater good can we offer society than if we discovered the key to unlocking telomeres that...
McAllen!
Look! I don't need this! I don't need
your
lecturing!
Well, you clearly need something. Whatever's fueling your obsessions isn't...
Excuse me.
Excuse you?
Hello? Sedgwick? What is it? Yes, of course. What's wrong with her? Are the delusions returning? Yes, I'll be right over. No, right now.
Dr. Orsel, where are you going? McAllen!
I'm sorry, Dr. Reiner, I'm sorry, but I have to go.
McAllen Orsel hailed a cab on York Avenue outside Rockefeller University and gave the cab driver an extra 20 to step on it to get to 1076 Fifth Avenue, where her grandmother had resided for the past 20 years. The uniformed doorman gave McAllen a familiar nod, and another uniformed man operated the ornate elevator cabin that took her to the 15th floor. She exited the elevator.
McAllen, thank you for coming so quickly.
Please, Sedgwick, it's my grandmother we're talking about.
Of course, come in. I know she wants to see you right away. She's in a bit of a state, I fear.
McAllen entered the exquisitely marbled foyer of the classic Candela pre-war apartment. Although she moved to her grandmother's majestic apartment when she was 12, she always marveled at the enveloping richness of it. Large iron-paned windows overlooked Central Park, and the ceiling was bordered by deep Baroque moldings. It seemed like every corner of the expansive apartment was inhabited by delicate French antique tables draped in royal velvet. The apartment was, in short, regal, and Amelia Orsel, McAllen's nana, was its queen. McAllen always felt safe there, allowing the thick walls of the apartment to protect her from the turbulence of her life on the outside, and especially of what happened to her parents so many years ago. Her safety and comfort was also enhanced by the presence of Sedgwick, her nana's butler for as long as she could remember. McAllen came to live with her nana when she was 12. Both of her parents had been reported missing and later dead while on a marine archaeology expedition in the remote southern Pacific near Pitcairn Island. Living with her Nana meant being subject to her strict regimen of academic excellence. McCallum was constantly reminded that she descended from a long line of scientists and that high expectations were reserved for her. However, much of the warmth in her life in Nana's apartment was provided by Sedgwick, the best friend a young girl or grand dame could ask for. He stood almost grotesquely tall, at almost 6'8", and his skin was the darkest brown could be without being black. And although he was painfully slender, McCallum was always amazed at his strength when he lifted furniture around the apartment to suit Nana's constantly changing tastes, or when he shook McCallum's hand. But when she looked at him, she mostly saw the wise gentleness of his Gujarati Indian descent. He always remembered that McCallum liked her salmon salad sandwiches with lettuce chopped within, and her breakfast bacon served slightly limp. He cared for her like his own child, but always remained appropriately distant, yet never cold. Hearing his voice and seeing him guide McCallum into the living room felt warm and familiar despite the sad circumstances of her visit. McCallum's grandmother had been deteriorating in health for almost a year. Her decline was particularly agonizing to watch because it was her mental capacity that seemed most affected. Her body seemed to be healthy, notwithstanding the usual minor infections or colds with which someone Nana's age would be afflicted. Some weeks were better than others, but for most of the past year, Amelia Orsall was bedridden and subject to intense hallucinations and delusions. On the way to the living room, McCallum passed her favorite painting in the apartment that hung in the foyer. This was quite a statement, considering the company that the painting was keeping, among a Monet, a Raphael, and two Panini. The oil painting, which was dated 1885, portrayed an older woman, perhaps in her late 60s, sitting beside a table strewn with heavy leather books, candles of different lengths, as well as several strange-looking flasks and colored bottles. The woman seemed more confident than most women depicted in that era. She was maternal, but seemed to carry an imperial demeanor over the items and accoutrements that lied before her. Her gaze seemed to convey a conspiratorial amazement. When McCallum saw it, she immediately thought that this must have been one hell of a woman. Over the years, McCallum's affection for the painting grew exponentially when she learned that it was the portrait of her great-great-grandmother, literally her Nana's grandmother.
I love looking at this painting. It always makes me smile, even when I'm sad.
You've always loved it.
I can't believe how much Nana looks like her grandmother. It's uncanny. Look at their eyes. It's like they were sisters.
I can see them in front of me now. You forget that you all share the same eyes. All Orsall women are blessed with emeralds to see from.
I see you haven't forgotten how to flatter a woman. How is she, Sedgwick?
She's been fading in and out, but I fear she's growing weaker. It's been rather downhill since the beginning of the week. In fact, she had a difficult time recognizing me these last few days.
Has she been taking her olanzapine? Did you make her take it?
Of course, but the beneficial effects of the medication seems to be lessening. I won't lie, it's been getting worse, McCallum. Today was the first time she actually lost consciousness.
How long?
About 3 hours.
You should have called me sooner.
But typically Madame Orsall despises being fussed over, despite the fact that her health is in danger. But this time, this was different. When she regained consciousness, she began repeating your name, almost like a mantra.
My name?
Well, mostly.
What do you mean?
Well, bear in mind that she was in the throes of delirium, but after repeating your name over and over, her voice would fall to a whisper, and she would say the word, Leviathan. Do you have any idea what she could have meant by that?
I have no idea, Sedgwick.
Come. She's in her bedroom.
Nana?
McCallum? Is it you, dear? I'm so glad you are here.
I am. I'm right here, Nana. Can you feel me squeezing your hand?
My hand?
Yes, Nana, your hand. Can you feel me?
It's hard. Yes, now I can feel you. Oh, McCallum, I've missed you. There's so much to tell you. I'm getting stronger, you know.
I know, Nana. You're going to be better soon.
Oh, not better, McCallum. Stronger. I can't quite see you. It's hazy, but I can feel you. I know you're with me. Oh, McCallum, I'm so glad you're here. I don't feel like there's as much time anymore.
You have plenty of time, Nana. Stop talking like that. You just said you're getting better. I mean, stronger. This is going to pass. We just need to change the medication that you're on.
Helen, darling, you're so special. So special.
I think you're special, Nana. And we're going to get through this.
You need to understand how unique you are. I mean it, McAllen. You are so special. Oh, McAllen. 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 McAllen.
Stay with me, Nana. Don't lose yourself. Try to focus on my voice.
Yes. Your voice. Your voice. There's no one like you. There's so much, McAllen. So much of it.
So much of what?
What?
You said that there's...
Oh, McAllen. McAllen. How are you, my girl?
I'm fine, Nana. I'm fine.
How are things at the university?
They're fine. I mean, not fine. Difficult. But I don't want you to worry about that.
How is your research progressing? Have you isolated the telomere stem cell?
I'm seeing some progress. I'm not getting any help from the university, and I think they're going to cancel my grant. But I think I'm getting close to finding the aging gene. I know it would revolutionize treatment of so many conditions, including... Well, I could make you feel better, Nana. God, I feel like I'm so close.
I can't hold on much longer. You'll need to find the key, McAllen. My special McAllen. The key.
Nana, stop scaring me. You're going to be fine. Even if I can't find a cure or a key, you need to fight now.
Do you know if... I mean, have they... Oh, no. Stop. Where...
Nana, do you hear my voice? Can you understand me?
Yes, dear. I think I can. It's hard when there's so many of them.
So many of whom?
The voices.
Nana... What is Leviathan?
What did you say?
I said, what is Leviathan?
They couldn't have found you. I said you were special.
Nana, what are you saying? Who?
So dark. McAllen, it's so dark and so cold. No one knows how deep. So deep. So deep.
Stay with me, Nana.
But Amelia also... McAllen's beloved Nana did not stay with her. She closed her eyes to yield to unconsciousness. Her rapid breathing gave McAllen assurances that this would not be the night of her passing. She was still very much alive. But McAllen could also see by the degree of her delusions that the end was not far off. McAllen was shaken to see her Nana, a source of such great strength and resolve, an accomplished scientist in her own right, the one who taught her that anything was possible, now lay in her bed biding her time until passing. McAllen felt her throat begin to tighten, and she let go of her Nana's hand and walked to the living room.
It's so sad, Sedgwick.
I know how much seeing her like this must hurt you. May I prepare a pot of tea for you?
You're so kind, Sedgwick, yes. Please.
Jasmine or Darjeeling?
I think you should know the answer to that by now.
Jasmine, of course. I'll just put the pot on.
It struck McAllen for the first time that very soon her life would be without Nana in it. It was like the first time you glanced at your parents and noticed that they looked older and frailer. Nana had always seemed old physically. McAllen had her perpetually aged at 65 throughout her life, but her Nana's spirit had remained indomitable. McAllen relied on that strength when she lost her parents. Nana had taken her in, and the two of them lived together at the Fifth Avenue apartment with Sedgwick doting on them. Nana didn't offer the maternal warmth that her own mother had, but she gave McAllen something different, a security of sorts, not financial, although that was a comfort. Although Nana was extremely wealthy, she had been steadfast not to spoil McAllen. When McAllen attended an affluent private prep school in Manhattan, she felt confused watching her classmates of lesser means take cabs and even limousines to school in the morning while she was relegated to public transportation. McAllen had been raised frugally, but she was never left wanting for the important things in life. She attended the best schools and received a brand new Volvo station wagon when leaving for Wellesley. But the security that Nana offered was that she would always be there to support McAllen, to tell her there was no reason a woman couldn't become the foremost genetic biologist in the world, and the security that another loved one in McAllen's life would not be taken away. McAllen spent the rest of the day at the Fifth Avenue apartment, drinking tea, crying, and squeezing Nana's hand in an effort to communicate to her that she would be there for her now. Cedric had been leaving the two of them alone, but finally re-entered the room.
It's getting late, McAllen, and you look exhausted.
I just haven't been getting a lot of sleep lately. One of my genetic simulations had me at Rockefeller most of the night. Now it seems like it's the most unimportant thing in the world. I'm so worried about Nana. Her blood pressure has been dropping as the day goes on. Which doctor has she been seeing for her heart?
Dr. Ackerman.
Could you give me his number? I think he still has her on the Coumadin, and I'm concerned that her medications might be causing her to have many strokes. When was her last CAT scan?
I'd have to check. But within the last year, I suspect.
Yeah, I'd like to know that, too, and maybe have some of the people at the university take a look at it.
McAllen, why don't you spend the night here tonight?
Oh, I should go back to my own place.
It'd be nice to have you back, for old time's sake. And to be quite honest, I think I'd feel more comfortable with you here if Madame Orsel regains her lucidity. I'm sure you'd feel more comfortable being here as well.
Maybe I'll just sleep in the guest room. Nana would never let me go in those rooms because she said she wanted to keep them clean for her esteemed guests. I guess I get to be the lucky guest tonight.
It would be my pleasure to prepare it for you.
Amelia Orsel's enormous apartment was like a tiny estate unto itself. It contained two guest rooms, which made McAllen quietly laugh at the thought that her tiny Avenue B apartment barely had enough room for her snowboard. But she was always secretly proud of some of the visitors that have stayed with the Orsel clan in their guest rooms. McAllen could remember luminaries such as Dr. Craig Venter, Madeleine Albright, Jean-Michel Cousteau, and Albert and Tipper Gore, all spending the evenings with the two Orsel women, young and old. And even as a young child, she sensed the gravity that her Nana, Amelia Orsel, exuded. Even when she was too young to truly participate in the lively discussions that always erupted over port and the end of one of Sedgwick's notoriously delectable meals, McAllen knew there was something special about her Nana, that people of such importance sought out her company. A sly grin crept across McAllen's face as she entered the guest room, where she remembered Laurie Anderson had taught her to play the tambourine in a surprisingly suggestive manner. The room seemed overwhelmed by the presence of an enormous mahogany four-poster bed with full canopy. It looked positively Edwardian in nature and possessed incredibly ornate carvings on each of the posts. The cloud-like mattress was stuffed tightly within the box spring and spilled out slightly around the edges. It resembled a loaf of white bread being baked in a beautiful wooden box. McAllen shut the door to the room and opened the dresser that sat to the right of the bed. Cedric had moved some of the clothes that she always kept at Nana's into the dresser. She laughed aloud when she found a calf-length pink silk nightgown that she hadn't worn in years. It always surprised her how something so light could keep her so warm, especially when her toned arms were bare. But the presence of the antique four-poster bed seemed to impose a period feel in the room, and McAllen felt like a protected fairy princess, immune from the onslaughts of cell phones, blackberries, and the impending cancellation of her grant. As she slid under the smooth duvet, McAllen became easily lost in her own thoughts.
Oh, man. This is nice. This mattress must have been made by Scandinavian wood elves. I think I can literally feel my spine straighten. I need to come home more often. How many hours has it been since I actually was in a bed? I fell asleep on the couch after running the simulation the day before yesterday.
Jeez,
so about 40 hours.
Maybe. I don't want to think anymore.
I just want Nana to get
better.
Why
was she calling my name?
She knew I was there, and this episode shouldn't have come on so suddenly. Normally the signs of dementia, if that's what this is, have some warning signs.
Oh, shit.
Where did my earring go?
Damn it!
Did it go behind the mattress? I'll never be able to get this thing up. Cedric is probably already asleep by now. He can't help me. Maybe if I just... Maybe it's between one of those posts and the mattress. Man, this mattress is up against the frame so tightly. Couldn't have fallen between
these posts are... beautiful, but they're creepy. All those flowers carved into the post,
Wait, those aren't flowers. They're tiny faces.
All these years, I never noticed
that. I can't tell if they're happy or in pain.
Definitely creepy.
I wonder if this is the same bed that was always
here. God, it feels weird. Like the post is loose.
I think I can turn it or spin it.
I just...
McAllen turned the bedpost counterclockwise until it clicked into place. She stepped away from the bed, suddenly as the thick mattress she was lying on shuddered intensely and started to rise upwards, guided by the four ornate bedposts. The mattress continued to rise upwards until it was completely contained within the ceiling of the bed. To McAllen's amazement, in place of the mattress that was just there, now lay a spiral staircase with a red velvet runner heading downwards. Wrought iron wall sconces suddenly illuminated and seemed to spiral down the staircase wall. McAllen instinctively looked to the bedroom door to see if someone would be bursting in to investigate the alien mechanical sounds coming from an antique bedroom. But no one did. The red velvet stairs spiraled downwards into the shadows cast by the flickering wall lamps. And then she saw it glittering. Her earring, waiting for her on the last step.
There you are.
What the hell is this?
There's a damn staircase hidden under my grandmother's bed.
McAllen tentatively walked down the velvet staircase, shivering slightly. It wrapped around twice, seemingly descending more than one story. The staircase ended abruptly at a tufted leather door with an oversized silver handle. The handle had three whales spiraled together and was so large that McAllen needed two hands to push it down. She entered the room and was utterly shocked by what she saw. The door opened into a single room with no windows and no other doors. The only object in the entire room was a 7-foot metallic sphere. The sphere was dark grey, but seemed to shimmer surprisingly brightly when McAllen moved towards it, allowing the lamp light of the staircase to reflect against it. There were no seams or cracks on any part of its surface. The only feature on its entire body was a small slot and a single word engraved above it.
Leviathan.
You have been listening to The Leviathan Chronicles by Christoph Laputka. For more episodes and information, log on to www.leviathanchronicles.com.
What are you doing Saturday, May 24th? If you're looking for one of the most fascinating, entertaining, and intellectually stimulating days of the year, come to the Vancouver campus for UBC's Alumni Weekend. General admission, including entry to all UBC gardens and museums, is free. CITR will be there too. For a full schedule of events, go to alumni.ubc.ca. Proudly sponsored by Cowell Auto Group and CITR.
The question, what kind of cities do we want to live in? How do we want our cities to be? Cannot be divorced from the question of what kind of people we want to be.
Join me, your host, Andrew Longhurst, every Tuesday at 5 p.m. for The City, an hour dedicated to critical discussions of urban issues. Live on CITR 101.9 FM and CITR.ca. For more info, visit thecityfm.org.
And welcome back to us here at CITR 101.9 FM. My name is Brian McDonald. You're listening to Scald's Hall. It is coming up to 5 minutes before the hour of 2 o'clock here in Vancouver. And we just heard episode 1 of the Witch Hunter Chronicles and episode 2 of the Leviathan Chronicles. We played episode 1 of the Leviathan Chronicles a couple of weeks ago here on CITR. We have permission to use both of them on our show. Yay! And hopefully we'll be able to interview the creator of the Leviathan Chronicles. He said he was interested in doing so. I'll follow up on that and see what that leads to. Both of them are very interesting. Both of them were created as audio dramas. The Witch Hunter series consists of 9 episodes. It's a little bit less ambitious in scope, but it is very well done. The Leviathan Chronicles is, as its name implies, a complete monster. They boast a cast of 5 dozen actors. They have 50 plus episodes, and it's still not done yet. It's still going on. It's quite the production, and they actually spend a lot of money making it. At least by volunteer radio drama standards, it's a lot of money. By the absolute scheme of things, it's probably not. Both very, very well done. We'll be following both of them. We'll probably do the Witch Hunter series first because it's a little bit more tightly packed. There's only 9 episodes, and they're all relatively shorter, and there's a little bit more to them. This particular episode of the Leviathan Chronicles was very exposition-heavy. The rest of it isn't quite so much, because they were trying to set up a character that you're going to follow around for, like, 50 more episodes. So that's what they were doing. Whereas with Ludlow, we're only going to be following him around for 9. And as you can see, he's telling his story to death. It's kind of very interesting. There's a lot of interesting things to that. It reminds me a little bit of the Witcher series, at least in terms of tone, not in anything else. It's actually a little bit more reserved, especially in the violence department. At any rate, coming up in a couple of moments, we're going to be having Radio Zero with Tyler and Cam. Stay tuned for that. And we'll be back next week with a couple of more episodes from The Witch Hunter Chronicles here at Skald's Hall on CITR 101.9 FM.
Old or New Testament?
I think the New Testament.
The question is, Pilate. Remember Pilate from the New Testament?
What's this Pilate? He fiddled while...
Yeah, no, well, just a minute. Let me ask the question, then you can give me the answer, okay? Did Pilate want Jesus to be crucified?
Pontius Pilate washed his hands of it.
So did he want him to be crucified?
Yeah.
No. No. No.
Well, tune in every Friday afternoon, 3:30 to the Night Watch Show on CITR!
Well, find a good church. It'll help you.
Hey, this is Clem from White Cowbell, Oklahoma, and baby, don't...